Hello and welcome back to the TFT podcast. I'm Ryan, that's Matt. Hey, Matt.
They take like Caesar and no one cares.
That's right. You drink water, I drink gasoline, or maybe it's one of the others. But I know at least one of us is nice and one of us is mean, because this week we're discussing Jack White's Lazaretto, which is a record that we're excited to discuss. So as always, as is customary, if you have not yet listened to the recent album Lazaretto by Jack White, which is at the time of recording the number one album in the country on the Billboard 200 albums chart, pause this recording and go and stream it, waffles it, or listen to it on your ornate and detailed vinyl recording, which I hope we'll talk to about in a bit, and we will meet you back here in just a moment after these non-existent messages.
Vinyl, the finest way to listen to music on vinyl. I wonder.
Welcome back.
I was about to say, I wonder if Yo is buying any commercial spots, because I would definitely advertise that app on our show.
Yeah, it's Yo and Washboard. They don't really need advertising because they have the entire like blogosphere just doing their work for them. Yeah, exactly. I think we're doing putting enough evil in the world by always just like promoting Rap Genius. We're doing our part for bad things. So don't if you're curious, do not search Yo or Washboard. I repeat, do not Google these companies and their heinous pointless little products. But you know what's a company that I can get behind? Third Man Records.
Those guys are for real.
Are they?
I don't know, I watched this video. I mean, with their hats and their ties and their, you know, old timey stuff.
Yeah, in terms of thinking about kind of how to talk about, so Third Man Records, for those of you who are not aficionados, is Jack White's record label, and it's based in Nashville. And so for the last few years, it's been his kind of way of releasing his own music and engaging in experiments in recording, producing, and releasing music, right? So it's kind of his way of, you know, imagining of existing in the record industry, Lazaretto is the second album that is released under his own banner as Jack White. As most of you know, that he's a prolific artist, having recorded a bunch of albums with the White Stripes, and then two really prominent post-White Stripes projects in the Dead Weather and Now My Brain is the Raconteurs, featuring Brendan Benson, who I once read on a like little concert program, but a festival program, described as imagine all four Beatles in one man's body. And from that description alone, written by, you know, a publicist of this guy I'd never heard, who was like, you know, playing second to last at the Siren Music Festival in Coney Island, I came to hate Brendan Benson. I disliked Brendan Benson before he was cool. and I'm very proud of that. But, you know, part of how Lazaretto got on our cognitive agenda was a tweet from a listener, Julia Mathias, at Pop Candy, who said,
Pop
"Hey,
underscore Candy,
Pop underscore Candy. Hey, I have a suggestion for the syllabus: Jack White's Lazaretto. For some reason, I think you guys are not into him, though. So, Matt, are you into this Jack White?
I'm into Lazaretto. I think this is a great record. I mean, and I guess Elephant was good. I didn't get into it. I recognize what's good about it. I didn't get into it as much, but like, this is a record that I was thinking, like, do I want to buy this and like just listen to it all the time? I might even shell out for that ultra deluxe vinyl edition. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and we have the link to the video of Jack White and the label employee explaining the special features of this, of the vinyl. But this is a vinyl that has a lot of interesting features that are working with the technology of vinyl, of a vinyl record, which is interesting because it's relatively simple and is thought of as a pretty old and, you know, for a while was thought of as a dead way of transmitting and selling and buying music. And then there was a period where it was kind of resurrected. But I think what's interesting just about Jack White's, all the things that you see in this ultra vinyl release is that they make again and again this video of claims for innovating in the vinyl space, right? So this is the first time that the record goes from inside to out, and then there's like a perpetual groove on the outside on the first side. And this is a first. And they talk about other times when notable records of the 70s or earlier did some of these things, but that there are all of these firsts. There are hidden tracks that are in grooves that are under the label. And so you play them by playing at, I think, a different speed on the inside, the innermost part of the record, and it kind of plays through the label. There's two different finishes on the record, one matte, I think, and one glossy. There is a hologram, a spinning hologram on I believe the B-side. And I think the other one is that for, I believe it's Two Drinks, or Just One Drink, sorry, Just One Drink. There are two intros tracks, one acoustic and one electric, that merge together.
Right.
There are a lot of, a lot of bells and whistles that are, I think in part playing with the format and kind of, it's interesting to like innovate on something that like there's kind of this interesting like post obsolescence innovation that he's engaging in with vinyl of like, oh, you thought this was dead. In fact, there's like, even if new things came along, what was possible with this was not exhausted. And I would argue that there's, possibly that, which I just kind of fumbled my way through, is a way of possibly thinking about like the music on the record as well. Is that, that this is, that largely a lot of the core of this music, of the music on this album and in and Jack White's career in general, works within the blues or kind of blues adjacent musical styles, and that was part of a kind of blues and rock revival of the early 2000s. And I think that there's, just as some could say that vinyl was obsolete at a certain point, that that it could be claimed that that people moved on, whether it's the cutting edge or the kind of novelty industrial complex that we discussed last week on the Chromeo episode, that these things kind of moved on from the kind of blues or kind of neo blues, and it became kind of an obsolete area of coolness. And Jack White has kept toiling along in this area and trying to kind of find other ways to push this and find kind of expressive or creative potential within that. And so I don't know, that's at least one kind of stab in kind of connecting the packaging and the physical like artifact of Lazaretto with what's kind of going on musically and lyrically on the record.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think our talk, our sort of bugaboo about authenticity is really the right doorway in. I mean, fortunately, we have a hammer here, right? Because there's just a big juicy nail standing in front of us.
Yes, and that nail is wearing like an old-timey suit and tie.
Yeah, like a, what is that, on like a sharkskin suit or something on the front, sitting in a in like a very Southern Gothic looking graveyard kind of thing with a wrought iron fence behind it and like fallen leaves on the ground.
There in fact are dead leaves on the dirty ground,
right?
Which is a White Stripes song for not non-fans.
Yeah. And the Instagram filter applied to this album cover is,
you don't think it was just taken with an old camera? Like, I wouldn't be shocked if there were, just like rooms and rooms of old photographic equipment at Third Man Studios. Right. And then there, that you pull out the drawer and you pick like, that you pick your filter, but you actually pick the actual camera and take the picture with that, and then digitize it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking a lot about this, right? Like that the it's funny. It seems like the technological sophistication is what enables, right, this kind of nostalgic play acting, you know. Like niche marketing, you know, if there weren't an internet to get excited about the vinyl pressing of Lazaretto, right? If there weren't sort of 21st century communications and 21st century marketing channels, the whole business model of doing old timey bullshit for a niche audience, wouldn't fly. Like where would you advertise it? The Sears Roebuck catalog, you know? Where would you go with your old timey bullshit? How would you bring it to market? So, I mean, it strikes me that there is, you know, this is an old deconstruction, like this is an old saw for post-structuralism, where like when defining yourself in terms of something, when defining yourself against something, you're defining yourself in terms of that other thing. And so you cede a lot of your discursive authority to that. But let me suggest a related metaphor to the metaphor that you're talking about, or a related metaphorical analog to the actual analog of analog recording that you proposed. Because I said the word discourse, which means I think that like a buzzer goes off or a duck drops in from the ceiling, or the contestants win.
We get slimed.
Right. You can't do that. You can't do that.
Yeah, you can't do that on podcasting.
The idea of, I mean, I want to talk about, I want to actually delve a little bit later on into this vinyl thing, because I'm so interested in these special features and interested in the medium, right? Like, and I want to talk actually about the word medium and the etymology of the word medium, and some of the history of that. But, you know, but one thing that analog is, right? Like I took a set of related classes in college on electronic music, and I think I talked about them a little bit, because we talked a little bit about Varez and Steve Reich and you know, some of these early practitioners of electronic music, and sort of how it's gone. It might have been the Chiverges episode when we talked about that. Anyway, so...
And 65 Days of Static, I believe, as well.
Oh, yeah. Right? Okay, maybe that... Right. Maybe that was it.
Our post-rock episode.
Yeah, and Music Concrete. Just pausing only to put a little note in the show notes for myself to include some links to Music Concrete in the show notes, because that stuff is really worth checking out, and sonically still sounds adventurous, even given the, you know, even given the sensation-addled sonic landscape that we inhabit. I, uh, I remember early on in the first course, in the intro course, which was a history course, and the second one was a practice course in which I built a digital model of Yale's carillon by sampling each of the 54 bells. The professor, who was a composer and now sound designer named Matthew Sutter, asked, what do you think of when we say digital? What does digital mean? And someone shouted out the right answer, which was discrete, right? When you think analog, think continuous. When you think digital, think discrete. So analog, like vinyl, those grooves in the vinyl app actually represent, are an analog to the sound waves. Every point in time, they have a value, right? Like, because you're arcing between you're arcing along the waves, and at every point in time, you are somewhere along that wave. So it starts and it's continuous to the end, and that is analog because it is an analog to the actual sound waves. Digital sound is sampled. Right. Same thing. I mean, same thing. Digital video. It's sampled. It's done. You know, it's not physically anywhere. There are only so many megapixels in your sensor, and you know, that's the limit of your resolution. Sonically, you also have a limit of your resolution, and it consists in two things. One is the sample depth for CDs, 44.1. Kilobits. That means that from the bottom of the register to the top of the register, it could be 44,100 different settings. Right there, at every sample, there are 44.1K possibilities. And then the other thing is the resolution. That is the resolution. The other thing is the frequency. How many times per second do you sample, right? Oh, I may have these backwards. 44.1 may be the sample rate, not the depth. Yeah, 16-bit sample depth, 44.1 sample rate, which means we're going to take a sonic picture 44,100 times per second, I think.
Right.
And in all those other infinite moments in between those 44.1 sonic pictures, right, there's nothing. You know, there is no information about the recording in between those, in between each of the samples of the digital thing. Now, this is like pedantic and long, and I misexplained part of it, and I probably misexplained more of it than I realize.
Unsubscribe!
Thank you. We didn't want your business anyway. The reason I'm doing it is because in analog, there is one information, right? There is one unit of information. It starts at the beginning and it goes through the end. In digital, there are thousands and millions of units of information, and and we only reconstruct the artifice or the appearance of a continuous experience from these discrete samples through technology. I mean, the sort of the reverse of the technology that broke down the continuous experience into all of these samples. There is more information. And I sort of associate the vinyl, I sort of associate some of the intentional lyrical primitivism of this record. And I associate the blues style with a kind of hearkening back to a time when there was less information. Right?
Yes.
When you felt like you had a life and it was continuous, right? Yeah. It wasn't intersected by conflicting discourses at every time. Or, I mean, maybe the deconstructionists would say it always was, it always already was, you just weren't aware of it, right?
Right.
It wasn't part of the, but fuck them, right? Like, all post-structuralism, just take a powder for a second, you know, one's experience of oneself, right, was more, was more, or at least in this, probably fantasized, right? Like probably apocryphal, but still very compelling fantasy of a fantasy time we can feel some nostalgia for, right? It was a lot less complicated somehow, right? And sort of going back, it's not just sort of formerly cool, but having a resurgence. I think there is some sort of content to the nostalgia, in terms of a nostalgia for a time when life didn't seem so discursively overdetermined, right? When you could say, I've got three women, red, blonde, and brunette, without, right, like examining discourses of gender, of ownership, of hair color, you know. And
what's interesting, though, is that what follows that, right, the 22nd word on the album is digital. Uh-huh. So, right, that it took a digital photograph to pick which one I like, which is interesting, because it's not right. So that while there is this primitivism and is a kind of sense of trying to move to an analog to the analog in various ways, like it also isn't denying. There's not digital denial, right? It's being analog in a digital world.
And what are the implications of that? Yeah, I mean, on Three Women, just because we've sort of dug into this tune a little bit, right? Like, I think the sort of 5/4 figure that is the, you know, that's the guitar hook that starts this tune. I think that the chorus that kind of intervenes in the blues verses, right? Like, It adds up to kind of a sense of restlessness, you know, and the a sense of kind of restlessness and of kind of excitement or of you know, kind of vibrating at a high frequency of like wanting to kind of overflow the bounds, wanting to overflow the like the four square bounds of the common time with the 5/4 figure on the guitar.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I think what's also interesting instrumentally, and you see this throughout the record, but this introduces this, and, you know, one, you know, hallmark of the blues that I associate with the blues is kind of, you know, repeated stanzas, especially in the verses. But what's interesting that happens in this song and then throughout the album is that you get an introduction of one kind of a theme or a figure or a pattern, and then the breaking of that later on, right? So that the instrumental breaks that come in are not the same every time, but they're these different fills around that, right? So that you have these patterns of repetition, and you know, I got three women, red blonde hair, red, blonde, and brunette. And then, as you kind of get these patterns about, you know, be one in California, one back in Detroit, that get repeated later on, what you get, in between those phrases differs each time, right? And so that you have this, you know, in some ways that there's also a practice of, replication, rather than there being perfect replication, and kind of, you know, another thing that sampling allows you to do is just have the same thing again and again. And you have a chorus of lords, right? Or you have the Tune Yards chorus that is just many, many, many Merrills, right? And I think that what is interesting is that here there's like a deliberate attempts to repeat and overlay, but have there be difference between that, right? Have there be these, have there be gaps and spaces where there's like between what's being doubled or repeated, and that there's a lot that again lives in those spaces, and they're a lot bigger than these kind of infinite, you know, infinite in number, but also infinite in smallness in digital. But in fact, there's a lot of space, right? There's a lot of rhythmic space. There's a lot of kind of interpretive space that happens in that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, I think it's a particularly good point about the sort of the instrumental breaks in the verses on Three Women, right? Like, because you can imagine like sitting in GarageBand and copying and pasting.
Right,
you know,
right,
over the things, and that's sort of a hallmark of the sort of digital era is reproduction, right? It's interesting that I think the vinyl record, right, like, he's mastered differently, is all analog mastered, and is done without any electronic compression. To sort of not overmodulate the speakers, the signals, right? Like to bring it all to within a certain range of amplitude, and it's not the digital version is, you know, mastered conventionally. I mean, now in the presently conventional way,
right.
For, you know, CD or for MP3. But the vinyl is not, right. It sort of doesn't. I mean, one thing that, you know, there are a lot of ways that we're talking about it. I mean, homogenization is one way, replication is another way. And like one thing compression does, right, is it homogenizes sound. You know, if you look at a audio waveform that's been compressed, it looks like a thick stripe, across the middle without highs and lows. In the same way that an uncompressed waveform looks like, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's very interesting, right? That in this lack of compression, like that, I think that it's interesting how, like, in the, you know, once you are in the analog, right, like there's something exciting about this because of the, like, and you were mentioning the roots of the word, but I tend to think analogously quite a lot, but that it stimulates that. It stimulates kind of thought by analogy, because when you start thinking about a lack of compression in the waveforms, and you know, the things that are and there being highs and lows, then you think about, I think one other thing that's really fantastic about this album is are the arrangements and are the ensemble and the ways that the different parts of the ensemble interplay with each other within a given song or from song to song. And I think it's especially interesting because, you know, Jack White is known as a guitar guy. And you see this a lot in just the online discourse. As I was looking for materials on this album, there's so much that's like, guitar god Jack White releases his new album. Guitar slinger, guitar this, guitar that, guitar prodigy, guitar hero. And I think there are some, and I would like to talk about some of the guitar heroics at some point, because there's some very interesting things that are happening in the playing of the guitar and the kind of self-aware playing of the guitar. But I think beyond that, for a very guitar guy, a guitar geekery guy, some of the coolest moments on this album came from the piano or from the violin or from the acoustic guitar, from strummed guitar, and from just the interplay between these things, from there being highs and lows, and them being and this kind of juxtaposition or the interweaving. And I think that I think Alone in My Home is one that I really one of the first songs that really grabbed me.
Sure. That piano hook is really, really hooky.
It's really good, right? Yeah. And it's interesting because it's like at one in the Pitchfork review, they have closed by saying some great stuff on here, but you kind of end up wishing that it was just minimalist, like, and it was just like, you know, not so many bells and whistles. And you know what? Fuck those guys. Because it's, I mean, the rhetorical position of, well, this is, here's why we are defending that this is not as good as we thought, you know, earlier White Stripes albums were, rather than just copying to, well, we don't know if we want to go on the line by saying this is cool. We don't want to spend our cool points from our cool bank account,
right?
Yet, but we actually really like this record, so we'll say a bunch of good things, but say, don't you just wish? Don't you actually just wish it was, you know, that this was just a guitar and really primitive drums? And my answer is emphatically no. I think that having the having the mix and having these highs and lows and how they come together is really essential to what makes the record tick.
I agree. Yeah, I mean what that pitchfork thing is saying, right, is like, wouldn't it be nice if I didn't feel conflicted about,
yes,
about, yeah, liking this, right? Like, wouldn't it be nice if my job were slightly easier in terms of not having to actually really make an aesthetic determination about the thing I'm talking about. Yeah, but you know what? Fuck them. Fuck Pitchfork.
Yeah.
Fuck
you. We said it. All right. Breaking news. TFT comes out with a strong anti Pitchfork stance. No, I mean, I think it's interesting though. I guess in terms of thinking about some of the lyrical themes of the album, I think what's interesting, you know, you were talking about, I mean, I think that said, I do have empathy for some amount of empathy for writers of Pitchfork, because they are in an explicitly critical enterprise, and have built a reputation and a business model on that, right? That they provide reviews and that, you know, for a while, you know, they actually in some ways, I mean, I think that there's a lot to be said, and there's a lot that has been said about the rise of Pitchfork as the, you know, indie music blog of record.
Yeah.
But I think that there is a lot that was based on them, you know, that there's kind of two pieces of a Pitchfork review, right? One is the writing, or there's three pieces, right? So there's the three important things that kind of separate it from other kinds of criticism, right? One is the writing style, which was, I mean, I think that it harkens back to some of the most like verbally adventurous and kind of adventurous writing style of some of the earlier kind of school of rock criticism, some of this, the rock critics that we've talked about in our historical jaunt, you know, and kind of with Chris Gow as kind of the dean of that, self-appointed dean of that school. So there's this kind of the writing style, and there's like some, I mean, especially earlier on, there were like Pitchfork reviews that were you know, that were written with these interesting, weird narrative conceits of like, I feel like there's a Fugazi review on Pitchfork that's written as like a memo to a society of people who like professionally chase tornadoes or something like that. And maybe there's just like a paragraph about that rather than it being the whole conceit, but there's lots of kind of conceptually adventurous reviews. All right. So then there is the idea of the adding of the decimal point, right? Adding this kind of arbitrary granularity to their review system, right? Where it's not only so actually going from 0 to 10 is a lot more granularity than a lot of reviews that are maybe like 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 stars. But then they have all of the decimal points in between as well. But there aren't really, you know, rigorous subcomponents. And then there is and this was not around for all of Pitchfork's history, but at some point as it was kind of getting read more and more and shared more and more, they introduced then this third piece, this binary distinction of is something the best new music or not, right? Is it an editor's pick? And I think that, you know, all of these things combined in various ways, we're at the right place at the right time in terms of what was happening with digital distribution of music and ease of waffling or whatever it was at that point. It was other kinds of BitTorrent services were probably what was going on when Pitchfork was really rising to prominence, kind of 03, 04, 05. But that they had this reputation of finding the cool new things and kind of identifying what was, there were, again, two things that were happening. They were both finding what was, the new trend, the new style, the new genre, the new artist, the new local scene, and kind of putting it out there and anointing that. They were taking down a peg, kind of established, kind of conventional favorites who don't live up to expectations, and then also started legitimizing popular pop music or hip hop or kind of non-indie things as being relevant in the indie discourse. And so that, and I think what's difficult is that that creates a discursive prison of types of, well, we have to keep doing this. Like, this is what gets us these clicks and these ad impressions and these curatorial spots and so on. And so that there is a lot of reputational management that must happen in the editorial process as these three tools are deployed of the rating, the binary best new music, and the review itself. And I think what's interesting and why I kind of link this back substantively to what's going on lyrically
is that they have this, it's like this burden that they they have to take it up, right?
Yeah, it's the rock critics burden, right? there's the rock critics burden that they're carrying. I think what's interesting, I mean, one set of concerns that I see on this album lyrically, and it's not in every song, but there are through lines, are about isolation and separation and the relation of that to freedom, right? Because a Lazaretto, as I discovered when I Googled it, is a term referring to a quarantine island, a quarantine station, or leper colony, right? Yeah. It is a place where you are partitioned. And the name comes from, the parable of Lazarus, right? And Lazarus the beggar, or not parable, but biblical, I guess it is a parable, it's a biblical story anyhow.
It's not a parable, happened.
Right?
Well, there are actually two Lazaruses in the gospel. One is a parable of the poor man at the foot of the table, and the other is the guy who was brought back from the
dead. Right, and I think that though the one that is the, at least, and I need to think about this. I think that the beggar is the one that is the through line to Lazaretto.
The rich man and Lazarus, and Lazarus is a beggar, and he longed to eat the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table, but even the dogs would lick his sores.
Right, exactly. You see a lot of, you see this on Alone in My Home again, which I talked about earlier, where it says, you know, I'm becoming a ghost so nobody can know me. And that there's this sense of freedom through isolation. And there's also discussions of freedom in the closing track in Want and Able. And, you know, that specifically, right, the chorus of that is, who is the who telling who what to do?
Right.
And
that's
there
not
is,
me. No, that's not me.
Right. Right. And so I think that there is this interesting kind of discussion. And even I see in some ways, right, and I see that in and it's in Entitlement as well, and even I would argue is in Three Women. I would argue that the Three Women are Jack White's three prior bands: the White Stripes, the Dead Weather, and the Raconteurs.
And not the brunette blonde and redheaded women that he's been linked with romantically, specifically Meg White, Renee Zellweger, and his second wife.
I mean, which one of those do you think he's more likely to – which do you think he cares about more? I think it's about both, right? I think that there's an – I think that there is a interplay here.
Karen Elson, the name of his second wife.
Right. I think that it's – I mean, it's interesting that it's – that there are – that there – both of these are going on. And there's, you know, this kind of idea of – I think that there's these intertwining themes, because I think that you could read Want and Able in both ways as well, as both being romantic and about being kind of, you know, in the resolution of in the aftermath of kind of failed relationships and kind of reconciling or understanding being alone, and as a kind of reconciling being kind of creatively alone, right? And so there's a lot in this album about both sides of this kind of isolation. And on one hand, there are these elements of being a pariah, being an outcast, being not, you know, having something taken away from you, as he kind of discusses on Entitlement, but then also the freedom that comes from that. And I see that kind of both a desire for freedom and isolation and a desire to not be alone, that the having that in the creative space and in the romantic space,
right,
are not so different.
Say. Yeah,
right?
I was about to say that the sort of the creative or sort of existential freedom is sort of tied to the romantic freedom and the kind of problematic aspects of desire as a desire as sort of an isolating force and also as a force that kind of I don't know, sort of sets you free from captivity at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. I was trying to think that I feel like there was a line on that in Three Women as well, but I couldn't quite find it as well. And what else did you see as being kind of interesting? Like, were there any,
there's something that I thought was very interesting, which was the instrumental track in the middle of the album. And which one is it? Highball Stepper.
Yeah.
Is the name of the track. Is the name of the song. And the idea, you know, listen, can we do what we do? Is there a TFT without lyrics in music, right? Like, do we need the lyrics in order to, you know what I mean, in order to have a podcast? Or are they a crucial but not necessary
element? Well, that's an interesting question. I think that, I mean, we did, like you said, we did our, well, I think part of the answer to the question is that the we, so I think one can do it. I think for us and the way that we do it and what are kind of the tools we have in our toolkits and our interests, it would be a lot harder to do only a non-lyrical music. In part, I mean, it would be harder, but not impossible. And I think that it would be, especially my musical background is limited to being a percussionist, right? So that there's a lot of the vocabulary of music where I may have an intuitive sense from listening to a lot of music, and a little more of a technical sense on a rhythmic side and on the senses of meter and things like that. But when it comes to various melodic elements, harmonic elements, kind of, you know, compositional elements, and understanding then what those mean, that there is a gap in that, and then relating it to other concerns. So that I think that it's an interesting question. So in some ways, the counterfactual is, you know, what would the podcast be like that was, you know, in a world without lyrics? I mean, it's an interesting question. Like, how much are you changing in this thought experiment? Which elements you change, what kind of changes it the most, right? That, like, see what I mean? Like, are we in a world, are we imagining a dystopian universe where there are no lyrics, where lyrics have ceased to exist, and like hunter predator drones, go around through through the streets, and everyone's just like hooked into meat farms, and you know, it's like in the Matrix, which is my dystopia of choice.
You make it sound so nice. I mean, we should move there.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it's don't worry, that's Uber's endgame. So don't worry, we're all moving there eventually.
Yeah, the Google self-driving car, right?
Yep. Yeah, something has to power it, and it's your biofuel. You are your own biofuel. But go on. So tell me more about what you're thinking through in this kind of counterfactual, and what you kind of were, what your idea was.
Well, it seems like a lot of we talk about like three distinct things on the podcast, right? Like, we spend most of our time sort of situating the albums that we listen to discursively.
Right. Context, right? Yeah, providing context.
A lot about context, and some of that is the context that we provide, and some of that is what the artist is, statements by the musicians themselves, right. and sort of statements about the musicians or about the work by other people, right? So there's a lot of triangulation going on.
Right, and there's a kind of there's this axis of, like, or this complex of criticism and publicity and where they kind of keep eating each other's tails, right? Right.
And then we talk about kind of sonic the sonic qualities of a particular album. But that's usually pretty short compared with the first and third phases, where we do sort of close readings of the lyrics, right? And the lyrics provide a way of sort of organizing, of structuring, of organizing the songs, right? Of the verses and the choruses and the bridges. And I mean, they would be verses and choruses and bridges without the lyrics, but you can talk about development in perhaps a more productive way if you have lyrics to hang on to, rather than like having to get into the sort of technical stuff, the technical vocabulary of music and whatnot. So
you know, the least, my point is the sort of least emphasis in our show anyway is on the sonic aspects. From time to time, we talk about, the qualities of the recorded sound. We talk about, like the particular sonic announcements that begin a lot of path breaking records in the history of popular music. We talk about these things, but it strikes me that, like, absent, you know, if it were just at, if there were no pitchfork, right, and there were no lyrics on the records, and we were just confronted with a bunch of, I mean, it's a thought experiment. I think we'd be equal to the task, not to give away the end, but like, if we just confronted a whole album of tracks that were like Highball Stepper or variations on Highball Stepper, right? Like, but would there be as much to talk about, right?
Well, I mean, and I think what you're proving in talking about Highball Stepper is that we could, you know, spend lots of time not talking about the music. Because we can just extend the preamble.
To infinite. I mean, I thought Highball Stepper was interesting. I mean, to me, that, like, that kind of whistling motif that came, that, you know, the sort of high sound almost sounded synthesized to me, like almost sounded like something that the two guys from Churches had, like, labored over with a, you know, with some kind of, like, sound generation machine to make happen. Right. And, like, there's a ton of, you know, analog manipulation of sound going on, right? In terms of, like, guitar pedals and amplifiers and stuff like that. But the end result, right? I don't know if it's that the electronic musicians are mimicking the natural sound, or that the natural sound is mimicking the electronic musicians, or that they're both kind of arriving at a similar kind of sonic, you know, high pitched sort of sound with a kind of a whistling quality to it. I don't know how it arrives, but the observation that I make about it is that sonically it does sound like it could be something on the Churches album.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, like, just, sorry, one more.
No, go for it. Go for it.
Because I actually want to drop the deuce of knowledge onto this song a little bit. But the other thing is, like, the guitar motifs remind me of a couple of other songs, like Three Women. I was actually wondering if I was listening to the hook from Three Women just in an in an instrumental track, right? So that there is, like, the Pitchfork review calls this record out for being kind of a shambling mess and lacking a certain amount of coherence, because, you know, in terms of their micro genres, a lot of the songs are stylistically different. Though I do like that they kind of draw from a well of Americana that I think is nice. I think it's nice to hear that reflected in a record that's really popular, and not like, you know, the other Nashville, which is the sort of polished commercial country, which may as well be, you know, Disney Radio, just Frontierland Disney Radio.
Right. He's playing some real country music, is what you're saying. some real fake country music.
I heard some people were here to see some real country music.
Exactly. I wanted to jump in on this because I think that
but my point was that there is a unity, yeah. And I think you have to look at the level of, like, individual motif as they're sort of recapitulated and developed throughout the record to find the unity in the record.
I think that's exactly right. I think that echoes what I was saying earlier on about. about the instrumental breaks in Three Women. And I noticed that as well, right, that there are these motifs that are throughout the album repeated and reinterpreted and that mutate, right? That I think that in some ways the idea of genetic mutation, I think, is interesting. And I think that you see it, you hear it in this there is something almost progressive in this, and I don't mean progressive politically, but kind of progressive in that you have this sound, right? That, and what I, and again, even though we're trying to imagine what this would be like without context, I think that you nailed it, and what the kind of secondary sources corroborate, is that this started with a violin run through a guitar pedal of some kind, an analog effects pedal of some kind, and then doubled on, I think doubled on vocals. And so you have, you know, several things brought together to create this. And then you hear that as he starts trying to copy this on his guitar, it expands and becomes something else, right? That it becomes, it goes from, there's a moment, exploring this moment between a sound and music, right? That at a certain point in his attempts to create this noise that he's hearing, he then creates the music. And I think that that is like really, really interesting. And it's something that happens, that attempt and the kind of disconnect to what you are, you know, going from a noise or a, an abstract idea to its expression, on an instrument. And then that's expression as sound and that kind of relay. And again, kind of the gaps between that and the extent to which there is or is not loss of meaning or there's transformation within that, I think is really essential. Cause I think the other point where that's, happening in a song that we haven't really talked a lot about is that Black Bat Licorice, right? And specifically, he says, he lists a lot of things. He said, that's just a bunch of propaganda and it makes my fingers histrionic like this. And then he plays a riff and he says, and also like this, and does it again. And then later on in the song, he says, now state the same damn thing with the violin. And the violin does a version of the guitar figure. And there's one other song. He also does this on the title track, on Lazaretto. There's a moment, if I can find my tab, where he says, where is it? Right, where he says, I have no time left. Time is lost. No time at all. Throw it in a garbage can. And I shake God's hand. I jump up and let her know when I can. This is how I'm going to do it. And then he guitar solos again. Right. So there's a lot of times where there's a statement of something, of this is what I am expressing. This is what I am going to do. And then he does it through a guitar solo, right? And so it's interesting. I guess when I was thinking about it, it made me think of two things. The thing that we've talked about is it reminds me of, in some ways, of some of the themes that we talked about on Talking Book, right? Of the various ways that Stevie Wonder is making the instruments talk and speaking through instruments. And I think that there's in terms of a really interesting example of doing this with guitar, a great artist that I would love to find a way to discuss on a TFT at some point, a guitar player named Marnie Stern, has a track on her first album called, I think it's called Patterns of the Diamond Ceiling, where she tells a story, and it's this kind of fantastical story, and it's a kind of a spoken word piece, where she describes different entities that live in this in a world, and each one she associates each one with a very technically complex guitar figure, almost kind of Peter and the Wolf leitmotif style. So she goes through these and enumerates like these people, but back shuffle forward, their sound is weird. And she goes and then she goes back through again and layers all of them on top of each other.
Yeah.
And it's very and does it all with a looping pedal, right? So that there is a moment where in live performances it is recorded live and then reproduced. And I think that a lot of, and there's a few different things that I'm putting together here, but I think that, you know, this attempt to this attempt to kind of translate to translate or copy or capture an idea, whether that is, you know, the musical figure or the noise on Highball Stepper or these other more abstract ideas like, you know, jumping up and shaking God's hand or rejecting, an idea and kind of becoming histrionic and freaking out. So I don't know. Did you, that's kind of my take on some of those themes.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because musicians have another sort of frame of reference in which, poets too sort of have another frame of reference in which you can sort of direct your ideas at musical objects, right? And not at, like, you're talking about a kind of translation of a political idea or of a, you know, of a cognitive idea into musical form, right? And it's sort of cheesy because all translation is cheesy. But there's also like a, there's another set of ideas being developed, and which are the like pure, for want of a better word,
right,
musical ideas, and those also are sort of working out. I'm not sure what it adds up to, or if it has to add up to anything. I mean, one of the things we called out on Yeezus, or that you called out specifically, in response to my complaint that the thing didn't really add up to a coherent theory of Yeezusness, was that like one of the aspects of the record was a sense of working through, and I guess I've identified that in a couple other records, sort of living with conflicts and kind of struggling, yep, with living and kind of struggling with conflicts or with opposing forces, rather than trying to sort of resolve the contradictions or resolve the conflicts in a neat and kind of internally consistent way. I mean, it goes back into that 5-4.
Yeah.
That 5-4 riff that starts the record, right? That starts Three Women, which is, I think, as near as you can get to, to the kind of sonic announcement of,
yeah,
purpose, right? That is to say, there are five beats trying to fit into a four beat,
yes,
measure, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm a five beat peg in a four beat hole. You know?
Yeah. Well, and that actually reminds me of something that that stuck with me as my kind of lasting frame for understanding Jack White. It comes from the documentary, I think it's called This Might Get Loud or This Could Be Loud,
right?
That is the guitar nerd documentary that features conversations about playing guitar between Jack White, The Edge from U2, and Jimmy Page. It's a fun movie. I definitely recommend checking it out if you like any or all of those artists. but there's this, and there's interviews, individual interviews with each of them, or they interview each other, and they sit in conversation and they noodle around on their guitars. But there's the moment that I remember with Jack White that really just like clicked everything with him is that he was describing, and I tried to find this clip online and I couldn't find it in a few quick searches. But for me, it like stood out as the thing I most clearly, one of the like three or four things I remember most clearly from this movie is he talking about saying, well, when I'm on stage and I have like another guitar that I want to be able to play, I put, and I know that I need to get to it in a couple, this many seconds, and it needs to be this far away for me to get to it, I move it a foot further away. And so that I have to run a little further to get to it. I don't put it within reach. I put it just out of reach. Uh-huh. And that attempt to reach it and try to get there is where there's something exciting of making it harder than you need it to be for yourself. And I think and with that kind of, you know, detail, that's a powerful lens of you know, in terms of a statement of at least a process note of like, I am, you know, that, you know, it, for someone who has a lot of ideas and a lot of talent, you know, how do you and actually a lot of, to, you know, to take a word from a one of his songs, you know, a lot of ability, right? That, you know, if want and able are two different things, you know, that what, you know, then what does the, what, like, how do you, so in some ways there's ways to one way to read the difference between want and the able is not having sufficient ability, right? That if there's a, you know, we talked about bank accounts earlier, but if you have more want than ability, you know, it that seems to be one way to read this. But I think the another way to read the kind of able is having quite a lot of ability, and that really is, you know, that when you have a lot of ability is where you run into the, you know, that in fact, well, there's a social code. And so walk straight down that middle and do what you're told. Right. And so that there's this interesting thing of, you know, for being a kind of know-it-all or show off, how do you, you know, express within that, and I think one way to do that is finding constraints and kind of explore within them or work through ideas within those, right? So that there is an element of performance and ultimately kind of performance art here, and so it is not just in the way that he performs or in the visual elements, but that there is that the act of creating the music is part of the art itself, if that makes sense. And there is the music itself is performance art or performative in a way that is kind of not just that you hear it and it's part of the music, but it's also not just reducible to the music itself. That there is a kind of performance art that somehow combines the sound of the music and what it took to make it. Whether that is, you know, the ways in which the physical taxing of performing, or the physical pressing of, you know, these analog buttons, or the ways in which or the actual processes of recording and mastering the album itself, right? So they're all kind of part of this, yeah. And so I think that also links again to even some of the themes. And one song we didn't really talk about too much, like lyrically, is Entitlement, but, you know, in which he sings, yeah, I'm sick of being told what to do, right? And that, you know,
Entitlement is sort of, I mean, I realize we're close to wrapping up here, but like Entitlement almost has two different personas on it, you
yeah.
know?
For it. Let's close out here. So
the verse one persona, which is like, well, guys, everyone else is entitled and I want to be entitled too. Why can't I be entitled? entitled like all of you guys.
Right. There's this meta entitlement, right?
Right. Whenever I'm doing just as I please, somebody cuts me down to my knees, you know? I'm the kind of Jack White that buses splash with rain.
Exactly.
You know? Stop what you're doing and get back in line. And then verse two is like, is calling out these kids today who, but calling them out in a particular way, like not that they're awful, but that they've been given faulty assumptions about themselves, the world, and their place in it, and their relationship to one another. These kids today who take like Caesar and nobody cares. Don't they feel like they cheated somehow?
Right. Because like Jack White is someone who really like walked uphill to school both ways. Because he got out his topographical map and figured out a way that it could actually be uphill both ways.
Yep.
And that he actually,
it was a map. It was done by surveyors in the 19th century.
Right. Exactly. No. And I can imagine Jack White, you know, with these like old timey surveying equipment, finding the way, to walk uphill the most, walk uphill both ways, have the most laborious walk to school. And so that there's the meta labor of doing that, and then there's the labor of walking to school itself, right? And in fact, when Jack White says get off his lawn, he really means get off his lawn, because there are some really amazing like blue grasses on it, and he planted every single blade of grass himself.
Right.
And so there was quite a lot of sweat on his brow, and yet he doesn't even deserve that. It's just there, right? So yeah, there's this kind of ethic of work that's kind of in that, right? And that it being, both, like you say, there's both a burden of that, or an unfairness, and a sense of pride, and again, I think that contradiction and that working through is one of the several kind of personal and creative things that are these strands that are weaving in and out throughout the album, So if unfortunately you do not have listeners, do not have a God-given right for this. For this podcast to go on infinitely, and we're going to take the right to listen to this podcast away by ending it. And so we're going to start. So if you want to continue the conversation about Lazaretto, about any of the elements that we talked about, hit us up through the usual channels. The two main ones are Twitter at TFT Podcast, and on the show notes on www.overthinkingit.com. And we have great communities on both of those. So check both of those out if you haven't. Join in on the discussion. Share your thoughts on Jack White in general, on the broader discography and how you kind of see Lazaretto fitting in with that, on any of the songs that jumped out at you, what was cool musically, what was cool lyrically, and just share your thoughts, say hi, jump in. And until next week, it has been real.